Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
It's the weekend. Welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this week's episode, for the first time on radio, Noel Blair spoke to us about his murdered son. Just over 5 years ago, Cameron Blair was 20, with everything going for him in life, when he was brutally murdered at a house party in Cork City. One man is serving life in prison, and his identity cannot be revealed due to a Supreme Court ruling last week, as he was 17 when he pleaded guilty to Cameron's murder. His father Noel told us about his family's disappointment about the ruling, how he believes knife crime needs tougher sentences early on, and how they are now coping with their grief. After that, you'll hear our conversation with the very talented Ruth Medjber. She's a rock and roll photographer who works with Hozier. She goes all around the world with them. On the road last summer, Ruth was prescribed with weight loss medication. She told us how she got on and also chatted about food noise and what that is, and of course advised that you should only consult your doctor about these treatments. After that, folklorist Michael Fortune came into studio. 20 years ago, he and his wife Aileen Lambert went to Limerick City. They recorded a collection of stories from primary school children on both sides of the River Shannon. It was called The Banshee Lives in the Handball Alley. The result was a sort of Limerick version of Give Up Your Owl Sins. We talked about the scary stories and met some of the children 20 years later. And finally, we finished the week with Adam Harris as our visiting critic. We wanted the CEO of As I Am to experience sound bathing. But we also had a nice chat about his upcoming wedding and his new blossoming friendship with Rosie O'Donnell. Enjoy the podcast. Just over 5 years ago, Cameron Blair was 20 and a student in second year chemical engineering at CIT in Cork City. He was a popular kid, a keen sportsman who loved rugby. He had a black belt in karate. He had a whole life before him. On the 16th of January 2020, at a student house party on the Bandon Road in the city, he was stabbed in the neck. He was brutally murdered. One man is serving life in prison for the murder, and his identity was the subject of a Supreme Court ruling in the last week. We're joined by Cameron's father, Noel, who is in our Cork studio. Good morning to you, Noel.
Good morning, Oliver.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about you, your family, your lives as it was in January 2020 before all of this happened to you?
Well, Oliver, we were just, I would say, a normal working family, like, you know, Cameron at cottage, Alan at school, the Kath and myself working. Yeah. We're pretty normal, like, you know, there was nothing overly exciting about us, like, you know.
Life is in West Cork?
Oh, yeah, down in Ballinscarthy in West Cork, yeah.
And you run an engineering business there?
I do, yes, I run a late engineering business, and Cameron would have helped me out at times, like, you know, whenever he was earning a bit of pocket money, as they say.
Yeah. Was he good?
Well, it wouldn't have been his career, put it that way.
Right.
He was more academic. Cameron is very academic, you know.
He was very studious.
He wasn't a tools man, like, but he could adapt very handily.
And where exactly are you from yourself? Because we can detect it's not West Cork.
I'm originally from Tyrone.
Are you?
I've been down here now. I suppose I've been down in West Cork about 30 years.
Wow. So you had your whole life there, the family, everything is going, as you say, normally and well. Cameron's mum, Kathy, working away as well. He was 20 years old. Like, it's no exaggeration to say he had everything going for him. Didn't he? He had a whole life ahead of him, Noel.
Everything, Oliver. He just had done the first year in college, and, you know, the first year can be a bit of fun and a bit of, you know,
yeah,
having a bit of fun the first year. But the second year, then, it's things start to get a bit more serious. And he was actually getting into the groove, and he was, you know, he was a very smart fella anyway, like, you know, but he was just starting to move forward, really.
He was enjoying Cork City as well?
Cameron enjoyed everything. He was a nice lad, enjoyed a bit of crack, enjoyed the fun, but could also be very serious and, you know, compassionate fella in one sense, like, you know. But just by looking out for people that have been weaker than himself and possibly not up to speed, you know, in the education system or getting bullied or anything like that. That came to light after his death, that he had helped quite a few people in that respect.
Including on the night itself. It is the end of Freshers' Week. It's a couple of weeks after Christmas. It's just before the serious business of college gets going again. And Cameron, he's with his friends. It's a house party on Bandon Road. What happens?
Well, Oliver, they were there, they met up, they were having a few drinks before they went downtown. Then there was a drunkard hammered on the door, or pushed the door in, knocked the door in. And then there was these three other individuals turned up. The lads decided to let them come in and have a drink in the hope they could keep everything running smooth.
Yeah.
And then the owner of the house decided this is enough. The three boys were getting a bit messy. And then they said everybody was leaving just to get the other boys gone. Like, and then Cameron and the lads came back to the house, and then lo and behold, the three boys turned up again. And then things escalated from that when they were told they weren't getting in, and then that was the result. Cameron got murdered.
And everything we know, including even from those who end up convicted, is that your son Cameron, was the peacemaker. He was being very decent and sound to absolutely everybody there in the night.
Well, he's a great negotiator, you know. He's, yeah. he's sort of been going to law, not chemical engineering, because he's a great lad with words, like, and he didn't want no hassle. He was a very fit fella, like, and would have been very well capable of defending himself, but it's not something that he'd done. You know, he was just an easygoing lad, like, and he was a black belt in karate. He was very fit, but, you know, he just wanted to keep things running smooth.
He was the sort of fella that people would listen to and look up to.
A lot of people did, you know. A lot of people took advice from him. Like, he was like an old head, like, you know, and young shoulders. He was, and he could explain himself very well. You know, he's a great lad with words and, you know, an understanding of things.
There were these three lads who caused the tension to arise at the time. One is 14, one is 17, the other is 18.
Yeah.
They just get leery, don't they? And they had left and came back.
Oh, they had left, but either was one of them left and come back and then left again, like, you know. But I would say they were under the impression, or they'd been watching, and they'd seen the lads coming back into the house. And obviously, prior to that all, they had armed themselves, like, you know, in anticipation of something at a later date.
They'd armed themselves with knives.
From the kitchen in the house,
The 14-year-old just had a butter knife, but it was from the kitchen of the house. They returned. What do we know about the fatal moment for your son? Why, in an instant, this teenager stabs him?
Well, I suppose that's a $1 million question, but, like, you get people that are, and this is my opinion, like, people are just not good anyway. And the other two lads were at the door beside Cameron, one on each side of him, with knives. And this boy, obviously, one of them at an earlier stage said they're going to shank somebody. I believe that was to stab somebody. Mm-hmm. And then your man come in from the side and stabbed Cameron fatally in the neck.
That's the 17-year-old.
That's him, yeah.
And as it said in court, the delivery of the fatal blow, vicious, deliberate and cowardly. And Cameron didn't know what had happened to him.
He didn't see that coming, because the other two boys were in front of him with knives. And he was focused on the two people that would be in front of him with knives. He didn't realise the other fella come round the side and come in from the side and just a vicious blow, like, you know. So
they flee the scene, the killer among them?
They ran, like, but, you know, as you know yourself, they were got, like, you know.
They were got, and initially there's a false claim, isn't there, that Cameron threw punches himself, but of course none of that happened. And they
In defence of these people, there can be a lot of false accusations made and things like that, you know. Just trying to defend people, but it came to light that it wasn't the case.
Yeah. It's January 2020. How do you find out what has just happened?
We were just like normal. We had the dinner. We were sitting on the couch watching TV, and the phone call came through. And to Cathy, which is one of the lads at the start, and Cameron's friends. And then I think it was a medical person come on, and they said, did we want a police escort to Cork? Right. And when I heard that, I said to myself, this is something seriously, seriously bad here. And that was it. We drove ourselves to Cork as fast as we could, like, but Cameron was gone by that time.
You got to see him?
Oh, we got to see him, you know, but he had passed away at that stage, like.
My God, and he was only 20 years of age. Do you recall much about the funeral, even?
It was actually not a lot, like, but I know I can vividly see all his friends and all the lads from the rugby club, and there was just the amount of people, you know, come out in support of us, like, you know, it was just unbelievable, like, it was amazing, you know, just support and stuff from people. It's, and still to this day,
yeah,
Cameron's friends turn up at the house, like, they come over and visit us.
Wow.
Which for young lads at that age, I think is, you know, it's very, very nice. It's very nice for us.
It's a lovely thing to do, and it's a sign of the man that he was, and he was meant to be, really.
Ah, yeah. It was, he was a fella now that he would have went far. You know, he was just, if you hadn't met him, you would know, like, you know, he was a fine lad.
Now, usually in these cases, we hear the justice system goes very, very slowly. The victims of family, the family of victims, they wait an age for something to happen. But this case moves very quickly.
Well, the main reason, Oliver, it moves so quick is because the system we have, that the system is more lenient on a person under 18. Mm. Anybody under 18 is classed as a child. About 6 months or less after Cameron was murdered, like, I was in the court, Central Criminal Court in Dublin, all because the criminal's counsel can force the situation that he has to be prosecuted before he turns 18.
Right.
And that was, we were so annoyed at that, like, but, you know, you don't have any really input. You either go and attend or stay at home. It will continue on without you, like.
You barely have time to grieve.
We didn't have time at all, you know. And especially, you know, well, I don't know, but in a murder, I think, in my mind, like, you know, it wasn't an accident, you know. It wasn't like he was at a car crash or something. Like, once Cameron was murdered that night, we seen him in Cork Hospital. And we didn't see him for another week. We had to wait 7 days before we got Cameron home. And that's just another thing about it. Like, you know,
I can't imagine what that week was like for your family.
I can't. I don't know. It's a blur, really. Like, to me, even at this stage, like, you know, I don't know how. Only for people. We had friends and family, and we just got through it. I don't know. You do get strength from somewhere. I don't know where it comes from, but it comes to you. You know, you get strength somewhere.
It's extraordinary.
It is.
The case that I'm talking about that moves quickly is that of the murderer, who is 17 years of age. You said it's just him at this point, isn't it? He pleads guilty to the murder. He was just weeks away from turning 18.
Yes.
And, well, you tell us his sentence and what happens after that when there's no trial.
Well, like, he got life. He got what the judge could give him. Like, and that was a sort of a mandatory session, not to be reviewed for 13 years, and then he reappealed it, and he was denied the appeal, mm-hmm. And then it has come to this anonymity situation, like, yeah. You know, this is where we're at now. And
the killer and one other young man, they were under 18 when they committed the crime, so they were not identified during the sentencing. And last week, the Supreme Court ruled to protect the murderer's identity from being revealed in the media ever, really. So he's well over 18 now. His anonymity must always be protected, including even in this conversation. We can't really say anything more about this person other than he was 17 at the time and is male.
Well, that's it, like, you know, and it's a very, very sore point to us that, like, we were really, really disappointed. I personally think it was a great opportunity for the justice system, for the country. They run the roost anyway. The system works in favour of them. Like, this individual can't be named, but every member of our family, from the youngest child till the great-grandmother, they're all, you know, there's no anonymity there. Like, everybody is out in the open.
Yes, I see what you mean, yeah.
And they've done nothing. You know, they're innocent. So...
too much emphasis is on protecting the criminal even after sentencing. What can be done? What have you said? Because you've been talking, haven't you, to politicians and so on, to legislators, particularly around parental responsibility of children's actions.
Well, to my knowledge, if you don't send a 14-year-old child to school, you will go to jail as parents. Mm. But the 14-year-old child can go out and he can assault your neighbour, he can burn your neighbour's car, he can do whatever he wants. But then all of a sudden, the parents aren't responsible for their child. So what we proposed to Minister Humphreys whenever we met her was, instead of putting a lot of resources into schools and stuff like this, make the parents responsible. Make the parents go to counselling. Make them, you know, and make them be responsible for their child. And that's not going to happen. Like, you know, I know we had the meeting, and the meeting really was all about just more laws, more legislation. We'll counsel them, more counselling. What I would like to see done would be the first offence for, well, I'm just going to concentrate on knives and weapons that can harm people.
Yeah.
There should be 1 year mandatory. No, nothing. No mitigating circumstances at all.
This possession of a knife.
Possession
the
of
first
a knife.
Instance.
Or, okay. Yeah, or a gun or anything that you can harm anybody with. The first thing, the guards collect you, you go to court, you go to jail or wherever. Some, you know, a facility enemy. Mm-hmm. And because once the guard brings them to the judges, the mitigating stuff comes into it. And they're out, and as we all know, look at the boy that killed poor Joe Grennan. He had 46 previous convictions. You know, why are these people allowed all these convictions? If that any one of them people on their very first offence, if they possibly were got a very, very strong sentence, like 1 year in time, may well possibly change the system, but as it stands...
it'll prevent what happens
down
the line.
Possibly.
The evidence from the figures from the Department of Justice, we say last year, they show the number of knives seized has kind of soared by 60% in the last 10 years. It was slightly down last year, but still over 2,000 knives are seized by Gardaí every year now. So that's what you're asking for, is that when they're seizing the knife, if they can link it to someone, and presumably they are, that should be a mandatory sentence for somebody, and it would just
mandatory
clamp down on knife crime.
Well, I personally think that, like, you know, if you, my opinion why the judges do it now would be a different, I'd have a different reason there, like, to keep the whole system running on. Mm. Like, if you can bring a man back, 46 times in front of you and convict him and keep letting him go. Like, he was out on bail anyway. I'm not really going to get into that. That's not.
Yeah, there are different circumstances, and obviously the judges are applying the law. And
they're not applying the law. That's the big problem, and that's a problem the guards have too. This is a problem the guards have, but they can't really be the ones that come out and start talking too much about it, because
true, they will have to listen to the defence lawyers who will obviously find the mitigating factors, which do often exist, and they are often factual. They're factual as well, to be fair. But I just want to bring you back to the Department of Justice statement, and they're saying that the maximum penalty for offences of possession of a knife, now it's possession of a knife with the intention of unlawfully intimidating or injuring another person, that it has increased from 5 years to 7 years imprisonment. But I suppose the bar is quite high, isn't it, to get there? They've also doubled the maximum penalty for assault causing harm under Section 3 of the Non-Fatal Offences Against the Person Act 1997 from 5 to 10 years imprisonment, and they've done both of those things in 2023. So that's what they're claiming has changed in recent years.
But why change something that's already there? You know, why go from 5 years to the 8 years or 7 years whenever 5 years has not even been in, you know, they're not even enforcing 5 years. Like, if a person goes up in front of the judge now, like, you know, obviously they play the system for months and possibly years before they even go to court. Then on the day they go to court, they plead innocent up to the day they go to court. Mm-hmm. Then on the day they plead guilty. Then the judge gives them a big reduction just because they pleaded guilty, even though it may be 12 months, 18 months later. Then they go to wherever they're going. That's if he doesn't, you know, that if he doesn't let them out, like on probation or whatever. They go to jail. They're a good little lad for a while. Then the governor, he'll let them out, like, you know, on a sort of a temporary release, mm-hmm. which is effectively complete freedom if you don't commit another crime, but if you're out on temporary release. So the whole thing is watered down. The judge waters it down, and the prison service water it down. Like, so effectively, they get nothing.
Our sentencing is much lower, yes, compared to particularly in Britain. We have a CSO figure. It says 1 year reoffending. This is just for 1 year. It's 2021 reoffending rates for individuals released in 2021. 42% reoffended within a year after being released from custody. This is essentially your point.
It is because, what have we got to stop them? Like, at any, there's no deterrent. There's no really a deterrent for an offender not to reoffend. You know, they could keep reoffending, but they know the system. They go up in front of the court. They cry that they're fond of drink or fond of drugs. They're fond of this, and we have a bad family home, like, you know, and all this nonsense. You know, like, there's so many people had hard times when they were young growing up, and they didn't have this and didn't have that. But mm-hmm. they don't go out and murder people. You know, so, like, I don't know. I think, in my own personal opinion, well, and our own opinion, we'd be saying the judges are 100% in, have the power in front of them to do what needs to be done to help solve the problem. You know, you're not going to solve everything, but
it's the early intervention, isn't it?
I believe, and what the justice system are saying, early intervention in their eyes is go to the schools and talk. But in my opinion, every school should be issued with a letter. I think the law should be brought in. It's every child and every school should have a letter home with them that if there is any person caught with knives or anything to that effect, they will go to jail. And the parents need to know this too, because a lot of parents would be aware, I would think, that their own children are not up to any good. Like,
in fairness to the trial judge in your case, Justice Paul McDermott, he said, you know, the deliberate recourse to knives by young men must be deterred and the public must be protected. And for that reason, he said he was handing down a life sentence to the man for that murder. In terms of the legal issues around this case, I think the final hearing is it next 26th, Wednesday in the Supreme Court. What happens on that day?
Well, to tell you the truth, Oliver, I would say very little. All they'll do likely is just rubber stamp what they have already said.
It's a formality ruling.
Like last week, we were under the impression that they weren't going to make a decision until the 26th. Mm-hmm. But then it transpired. Obviously, we'll be in courts and you have people, you can't hear them, what they're saying, and the legal jargon. And we were of the opinion it was going to be the 26th before it was deliberated on or whatever the decision was made. But it has transpired that the decision has already been made, and there's no way the seven judges are going to change their tune now. Like, you know,
it was publication, and you were on your way back home to West Cork, was it, having come up for the Supreme Court?
Yeah, well, we come up, like, you know, we have always attended court, and you know, and for Cameron's sake, like, and we were of the opinion, like, it was going to be the next week, and then one of Cameron's friends, he forwarded on, I don't know, he got the copy of the judgment or something the newspaper had printed.
Yes, it came out in the media, yeah.
To Cathy, and then it transpired that the deal was done, like, you know.
It's the formality next Wednesday, which you will go, because you always go for every...
Well, we'd be there.
You've been there all the time.
We will always be there, like, you know, if need be, we'd be there.
The finality to these legal hearings and the fact that it's the Supreme Court, is there any solace at all that this will be, you know, the end of travelling up and down to courts? Is there any comfort at all there?
Or up and down to Dublin, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Whenever you're making progress, we don't mind. We go any place or do anything. If we could, make progress in some of these things we've discussed.
It's an incredible story, and that's obviously, thank you so much for sharing it with us once again. I've noted in 2021, after one of the cases, you said Cameron always had a positive attitude, and although there's now an emptiness in our world that can never be filled, we'll try to honour his memory by living the best life we can. How have you been getting on with that?
If you're just a normal working family, Oliver, you know, there's, you know, you just sort of have the same ding-dong every day, like, you know. Mm. And keep the chin up, because there's other family members as well, you know. And you just have to keep, like, if one person goes down, you're inclined to pull people down along with you.
And I know you've another son who was younger than Cameron, so you're looking after him, and I know you want to keep him out of the public as much as possible.
There's times he's looking after us.
Is that right?
You know what I mean? Like, he's a great lad too, like, and he's got the same sort of an attitude to things as Cameron, like, you know, that, you know, there's things he can change, there's things he can't change, and you just have to struggle on, keep going.
It's incredible that you're able to have even these conversations, so fair play to you. And I know you're doing it for purposes, you're saying it's for other people now at this point.
It is, yeah. Well, that'll be the aim, like, you know. It's it's sad that we have the laws there. The law is there. Mm. And there only is one person that can enforce the law, and that's the judge. He has the rule book in his hand. The rules are in the book, what he can do. And all he has to do is apply it at an early stage, you know, and then possibly we may see a change in the results.
Well, listen, I hope that they're all listening to you, the legislators, everyone involved is listening to you this morning, Noel.
And I hope so.
All we can say is pass on our sympathies again to you and to Cathy and to your other son on the loss of Cameron. But Noel Blair, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Oliver.
And look after yourself. If anyone out there has been impacted, supports are available on rte.ie/helplines. Weight loss medications have transformed the battle against obesity. They've been a lifesaver for those with conditions such as diabetes. And now the next generation of the drugs are also revolutionising the battle against the bulge, and increasing numbers of people who don't have diabetes are going on them. And is there a bit of vanity going on? What is life like on these weekly or sometimes daily injections? Ruth Medjber is a talented photographer who last year decided to go on one of these drugs, and she's here to report on how life is going. Well, we've loads to talk about, Ruth. Welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you.
You're a photographer, rock and roll photography.
Mainly, yeah. But as you know, during COVID, I pivoted, as they said. But yeah, my day-to-day is tour photography. I travel around the world taking pictures of bands, musicians. I'm very lucky in what I do. Yeah.
You've been with Hozier for years, haven't you?
Yeah. So for the last 2 years, he's been on tour around the world, just really knocking it out of the park. And I've been there to document it all.
You've been there for all 2 years of the touring. And it was a lot of touring.
It's a lot of touring. We went around the world again and again and again.
Australia, everywhere.
Australia, South America, the works. It was fantastic.
Wow, but it's hard work at the same time.
Grueling. It's grueling, but it's great crack. So you really need your fitness for it, you know? And you need to be on the top of your game, mentally, physically, everything to get through it, because it is a very, very hard lifestyle. It's a lot of travel. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of running around stadiums and arenas.
What's the entourage for Hozier like? Are they as sound as you'd expect? On brand?
You know when people say, oh, we're like a family. It really is.
There's
a core crew of beautiful people that I adore, and I love to call them my friends. So, yeah, I miss them when we're not on tour. I live on a bus with 9 men, but they're the loveliest men you'll ever meet.
Really?
Yeah.
God, you hear that, because, you know, the sort of nice person brands have been falling apart.
No, Hozier himself is just the sweetest, dreamiest, dotiest man you'll ever meet. It's sickening. So, like, he's just so nice.
It wouldn't be the healthiest of lifestyles, would it? Touring, I presume, and
no.
Staying up late and all that.
Yes, I stay up very late on the tour bus till 4 or 5 in the morning. I don't get an awful lot of sleep. And then it's the food as well, which is quite difficult. I'm a vegan. So you're at the mercy of whoever is cooking for you that day. You don't have access to a kitchen, you know. I've gone for 2 years and I barely made a slice of toast for myself. So you're either in a hotel doing Uber Eats to the reception, or you are eating in the venue and just at the mercy of whoever is in the in the venue cooking that day. So,
by the way, the job itself as photographer, are you roving around the gig? Are you backstage? Where are you?
All of it. Absolutely everything. You know, so I start the day backstage with everyone as they're getting ready. We do the whole show for 2 hours. I get on the bus and I edit for about 4 hours. The next day we might do some promo videoing, all that kind of stuff. So it's all go.
Goes up on social very quickly.
Everything that you see, everything we do is it's a day to day, boom, 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 very fast paced job. Yeah.
And along the way, a music video here and there?
I did an Al music video for himself. I did.
For a small song.
For a small little song called Too Sweet that, people may be familiar with. And I was thrown into that task. I don't really do music videos. Actually, I'm quite allergic to videos. But they asked me to do it and I had to say yes. And yeah, it was great. It got nominated for a VMA and I don't know how that happened. But it's just a shocking video, but I tried.
I mean, I went off topic because it had to be mentioned because that Too Sweet became the biggest.
It's a banger of a song.
It's an amazing song. I can't believe it's one of those off-album songs. It wasn't on Unreal on Earth.
You know, he needs more confidence in himself. He's like, oh, no one's going to like this. And we're all like, that song is huge. The whole world loves it. So
first Irish artist to hit number one in America since
he was 3 weeks
Connor,
old.
Since he was 3 weeks
since
old.
Since he was 3 weeks old. I know. He was 34 when
he
got number one.
No,
we love him dearly. But everyone's so proud of him. Do you know what you see?
He's due a bit of begrudgery.
Yeah, I know. He loved to hate
it. It went to number one all over the world.
All over the world. And we were on the road when it went to number one. So it was so exciting. We knew it was going to happen because the song took off on TikTok and the kids loved it. You know, like the teenagers. New generation of fans were connecting, engaging with his music. So it just grew massively. And I was hearing it everywhere. Every taxi in every part of the world I sat into, you just hear.
It's the bass line.
The bass line. That hooks you in and then now gives me PTSD.
So this has been the backdrop to your life for the recent while.
Yeah.
And an unhealthy lifestyle, as you pointed out. And this was getting kind of on your nerves, really, was it?
Well, you know, it's tricky enough. It wasn't getting on my nerves. More so it was getting on my thighs and my hips and my belly.
Very good.
Do you know what I mean? Okay. I was piling on the weight, like. And, you know, there's multiple reasons I was piling on the weight. My age as well. I just turned 39. Do you know, I'm creeping up. My metabolism is slowing down. Last year I developed sciatica, so I wasn't moving as much as I should have been moving.
It's a nerve pain. It's constant.
It's an absolute pain in the literally.
Quite literally.
And it was so bad. So I wasn't doing all the running that I should have been doing and all the exercise. So I was making myself miserable. I was eating bad, over-processed, sugary, high-fat American food, right? It's not like food in Europe. It's not at all.
No.
It's not fresh. It's not well prepared. And so just 2 years of all of that, everything getting down on me. My dog had died. I'd stopped walking when I was at home. Everything. And I piled on the weight. And come here, that's not unheard of for me. My weight, my entire life has fluctuated up and down 2 or 3 stone. Okay. Gosh. I'm not one of those inherently skinny people. I wasn't blessed with that gene. I'd often look at them and go, how are they just so skinny and they're eating the same thing that I'm eating? Look at a photograph of a donut and I put on 5 pounds. It wasn't for me. So yeah.
Did you post your pictures of yourself on social media? How were you feeling about your image?
Of course not. Like, if I posted any photograph of myself, you can better believe I edited it first.
Because you have that skill, obviously, on your fingertips.
Absolutely. No, I was mortified. I just wasn't feeling myself, you know. I put on loads of weight. I was avoiding photographs. I was avoiding parties. I was home only very infrequently for like 2 weeks at a time. At a time when I should have been visiting friends, I was staying in because I was embarrassed. Right. I was just didn't feel like myself. I went to a wedding last May and it was someone that I'd known for years and years and years. And I said hello and they didn't recognize me. And I could see it in them that they were like, oh, it is you. You're just... And
oh
they,
God.
I knew they were about to say, oh, you've just put on a lot of weight. Like, and then the next day, this is what really cemented it for me. The next day, I flew back to go on tour and I got on the aircraft and the air hostess, and I thought she was joking, but she wasn't, bless her, was like, would you like a seatbelt extender? And I was like, oh God, I've put on weight.
Ah, but that must have felt terrible.
Of course it felt terrible. Well, you know, like it, but as well, being overweight is nothing to be ashamed of. It's just for me, it was the realization that I had put on that much weight. But like people exist at that weight very happily and very healthily themselves. Like where you people are supposed to be so different. There are supposed to be bigger people and smaller people and people in the middle. But for me, I know where I am in that scale. For me, a healthy version of myself, my normal is where I am now, which I'd like to point out because it's radio. I'm not terribly skinny. I don't think I will ever be terribly skinny.
You look great.
I feel great. And, you know, when you feel great, you look great, regardless of what weight you're at. But I do feel like my normal self. But you see, the only times I've ever been skinny in my life was when I was obsessive about my weight and really down on myself. And it was a miserable time. And I never want to go back to being skinny and miserable.
Did you try diets and things like that? Is that what you were?
Are you mad? Did I try diets? I nearly invented all the diets. I have been on diets since I'm about 14 years of age. Every diet you can imagine. I used to call it Fat Club every Wednesday down in Abbey Street, and went to those programs where you went to your meetings and you had a leader and they bellowed at you for an hour. I did the ones with the shakes and the meal plans. I did the ones you subscribe to an app. All through my entire life, there has been people, corporations, organizations, everyone willing to profit off my desire to lose weight.
And they still do.
They still do.
And Camille, that's all to do with your image. What about your health? Were you concerned about your health?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, my family is a real mixed family, and some of them are mad skinny and some of them are not. Okay. And people really suffer with their weight in my family. And I could see myself going down the absolute obesity. No, I was technically obese. So I could see myself getting morbidly obese and it was slipping away from me. So I have to be very conscious of that and very careful of it, because when I'm so short as well, I'm only 5'2", and there's a history of cholesterol and everything in my family that's, you know, a fatal kind of diagnosis. And I was like, I have to mind this. Then coupled with the sciatica, I went to my doctor about the sciatica last year because it was stopping me doing my job. Yeah. I couldn't, you know, I was trying to do these shows each night. I was in South America. The shows are 2 hours long. I had to radio to my tour manager and ask her to bring me painkillers because I couldn't physically walk backstage and get painkillers.
And as a photographer, you'd put yourself in awkward kind of positions.
I carry gear. I have to be quick and nimble on my feet, and I wasn't quick and nimble on my feet because I was carrying the weight, and then the weight was impacting my nerves and the sciatica was killing me, you know, and my knees were very sore as well. You know, these are things that I shouldn't really be dealing with, you know. So the physio recommended instantly. He looked at me, he was just like, you need to lose weight. And I was like, Jesus, yep, you're right. Thanks very much. I was like, I do. So that kind of, between that, the air hostess and everything else, I was like, all right, I need to address this. And the fact as well that my clothes didn't fit anymore, that was a shocking blow. I have a lovely wardrobe of fantastic clothes I've collected my entire life, and they're all in a size 12. And then when I inched up to the size 16 and I couldn't get into those clothes for love nor money, that was a big awakening, you know. I love my clothes.
That'd be kind of a normal enough size, wouldn't it? 12, 16?
I'd imagine. Yeah, it
14
is.
To 16.
Yeah, 14
common,
to 16. But I'm quite short. I'm 5 foot, you know, 5 foot one, 5 foot two, depends on how I'm standing. So, like, if you're that short, the weight, it doesn't have a lot of places to go. So, for me, I feel comfortable at a 12, at a 10 to a 12, you know. So I can only attest to my personal experience and my personal weight range. And I feel brilliant at like around a size 10 to 12. Now, if I was going by that BMI scale that they all bang on about, I'm still obese. I'm still high in the BMI where I am now. But I don't really have any intention of losing any more weight because I'm happy. I'm happy where I am.
So you would obviously been reading like the rest of us, all of these medications that have gone on the market, and you go to your doctor?
Yeah. Now, listen, I didn't take these decisions lightly. I'm big into research no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm buying a car, buying a pair of shoes. Good. And be sure as anything, when I was researching this medication, I did it right. Now, I will say that the idea first came to me on social media because I'm seeing all these Americans take this wonder drug. And I was like, geez, that's great. I wonder if we have it over here. So that's when the research started. And when I mean research, I mean medical research. I was looking at medical reports, peer-reviewed medical reports. I was looking at all the statistics. Really? Okay. Oh, God, yeah.
Because you wouldn't want to take American influencers.
No. Would you take their word for it? Not at all. So I was kind of looking at all the studies, and these studies are done over more than a decade. So I was thinking, right, that's going to highlight X, Y, and Z. And then I went deep into the forums. So the chat rooms, people talking about their own experiences from different parts of the world, you know, the cons and the pros of it all, to see what other side effects people had. So these were all things I needed to really consider before I even approached my doctor. And then I went to the doctor. I was like, and he was like, yeah, okay, you've obviously done your research. You fall into the brackets of it. And I would agree it would help your sciatica if you lost weight. You know, and it wasn't just a, people always say this to me, and this is what drives me up the wall. It's like, why don't you just eat less and move more? I can't move more. I'm in pain. I'm crippled with the pain. Okay, now I move more because I've with the weight off me,
right?
And I love the gym now. Well, I don't love it, but I do it. And the eat less.
And you
thing,
can do it, isn't that the?
I can do it. You know what I mean? So listen, I do try. It's not for lack of trying, and it's not for lack of willpower either. People think that like, oh, you're taking the easy way out, and da 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 da. I tell you, you don't know me. I'm a very strong-willed woman. I can do anything once I set my mind to it, and this was the remaining option for me and the smartest choice.
Okay. And you don't have type 2 diabetes, which is what many of the drugs in the market, like Ozempic, for instance, is only prescribed for. It's not Ozempic, the drug you went on.
No.
It was specifically for weight loss. Was it?
Yeah.
Was it an injection?
It is an injection. And Ozempic isn't only prescribed for diabetes. It's prescribed for obesity as well now. So they all are, you know. So the drug started off, I believe, as a diabetes medication. But then, you know, I won't have
developed these side effects.
Yeah. I won't have diabetes now, because I'm not going to be morbidly obese, you know, and I'm not going to hopefully suffer with my knees anymore or my sciatica anymore. So
the doctor prescribes this. It's an injection.
Yeah.
How often do you have to take it?
I take mine daily.
Every day?
Every morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got the box with all the sharp spin.
Yeah, the sharp spin, my needles, everything. And it's the tiniest little like hair size needle. So you don't really feel it. So it's grand.
Did you start taking it while on tour? Working? That seems like a mad time to start.
I know, but that's my life, you know. And it's not something that I was doing willy-nilly. I knew it had to be a life-altering change that I was going to have to do for potentially the rest of my life. So why not try and start it while I was on tour? Now, there's it's probably a bit of an idiotic move taking it on tour because you're on a tour bus. And, you know, when you're on a tour bus, you don't really have access to the best facilities. You know, you can't, you're not supposed to flush a tour toilet or a tour bus toilet.
Like. Oh, really?
Yeah. So when the side effects include vomiting, diarrhea, nausea and stuff,
right,
you're like, oh, wow, I have to consider this. So there is a touch of that, you know, you do when you up your dose and everything like that, your body takes time to adjust. But it was nothing that wasn't manageable. Yeah.
You're not squeamish around needles and things like that?
Not anymore. Although,
not anymore. And of course, you don't see the needle in these contraptions nowadays. A pen is what they call them.
Yeah, it's not like an EpiPen.
Oh, so it's not?
I know. An EpiPen is what I have as well. You don't see the needle, you just press it to your skin. But this one, you very much do. You screw it in, you see the needle, you pop it into your abdomen.
Right.
You know, any bit of flab on you, on your arm or your leg. You should have a lot of flab on you anyway when you're doing this medication. So into my abdomen. And it's fine. It's not a bother. But they are making advancements, I believe. America and stuff, they're going to have you just take it in tablet form, so they're progressing all the time. So I would say I'm not going to be injecting myself every day for the rest of my life. I'd say it's going to be akin to, you know, a contraceptive pill where you take it every day at the same day, and this would be as simple and easy as that
at the same time. And so you didn't have the side effects you were looking
at? Oh, I did.
Okay.
I had bits and pieces of everything.
God, that's unpleasant.
It's unpleasant, yeah, but you do have to make sacrifices. You're not taking this, like I said, lightly. It is a big change. And it's a change, obviously, you know, physically you do feel nauseous. You might have a touch of vomiting. You might have a touch of diarrhea or whatever, but it passes. And then...
Because you're upping the dose.
You're upping the dose
to
get to your full dose, within the month. And then...
What's happening to you, to your body? Is it aimed at suppressing your appetite? Is that what it does?
It's a slow release of food, so you feel fuller for longer. You get more out of what you're eating. So when you feel fuller, you don't eat as much, which is great for portion control and everything. But what I found it did for me was a couple of things. One of them is food noise that I'd love to talk about because that was the huge thing for me. And then...
What's food noise?
Food noise, right? I didn't realise what food noise was until I was reading about it in all these forums. And I was like, wait a second. Are you telling me that what's going on in my head isn't normal? So in my head, there's this voice. But there would always be this critical, urgent, anxious voice in my head talking about food. So if before I was on this drug, if I was coming into you today, and even though this whole trip door to door is going to take me less than 2 hours, I would have packed a bag of snacks because I would have always been anxious about, I'm going to be hungry. Where's my next meal coming from? Is it nutritionally balanced? I was always really worried and just so stressed out about food in my life. And then food would make me feel tremendously guilty, you know, if I had eaten the wrong thing, if I was kind of binging a bit, and then I'd feel awful about it. So
beating yourself up all the time.
Yeah. And I think it comes from an entire lifetime of being on a diet and tracking my nutrients and tracking calories and counting points and doing everything that I've been trained and conditioned to do. So I have this constant fog in my head. It's like someone, when I took my first injection, it was instant. It was like someone had turned off the radio in the background of my mind.
Really?
Yeah. That was
the food noise was gone.
Food noise was gone instantly. And I felt such a relief. Now I don't panic about food. I don't necessarily research the restaurants around the RTE studio in case I need a quick snack. I don't fear that I'm going to get hangry during a photo shoot or my blood sugar is going to drop and I'm not going to be able to continue to work. I don't panic about things. I know now that I can go long periods without eating, and I know.
And your side effects from the drug, have they gone away?
Oh, they're gone. Yeah, I've been on this since July. They're all gone now. I feel fine. I'm absolutely top health, like, so.
So essentially you lose weight because you're not eating as much as before?
You're not eating as much as before, but you're eating different food. I no longer crave sugar and grease.
Right.
Honest to God, grease. I used to love a Chinese. I used to absolutely love a Chinese once a week. It was my little thing.
Yeah.
It was a treat to myself. Now the thoughts of a Chinese would kind of make me a bit sick, you know?
Even if you just wanted a treat once a month now that you're in your new healthy...
A treat would be something kind of different now for me. It would be a nice meal, like a healthy, balanced meal. Like I've eaten salads. I've never in my life eaten salads and now I'm mad for salads, you know? I used to love, you know, crisps and jelly tots and no, they're all gone now. I don't have the same craving as I used to. I don't go to the fridge and snack. I don't have the need to just eat and eat and eat. It's just not there.
This is why the junk food industry is terrified.
They're all terrified. The junk food industry, the weight loss industry, they're all terrified of this drug and they're all trying to make us feel guilty and shame about taking it, you know?
Now, the upside is that people are worried that maybe the people are not eating enough now as a result because the diet is...
Yeah, I could probably see that happening, that people... It's probably that they're not eating enough, but they're probably not eating a balanced meal. So I do have to be very careful about what I'm eating. I have to make sure I'm getting my protein and my fibre and all of my nutrients in there, you know. But it's grand. I have years of training from diet culture to tell me how to do that.
Right. Okay.
You know what I mean? But yeah, I would. I think it's something that needs a lot more education around, that people need to know how to eat better. They just need to know what their body needs.
Is it expensive?
It's not cheap, but it's something that I'm willing to invest in. My health is always something I'm willing to invest in. I pay around 220 quid a month for it, like, which isn't a huge amount, but for people who need it probably the most in working class areas, who are in poorer areas, who are eating a lot of junk food because that's affordable, maybe this drug isn't affordable for them. And that's a shame.
The drug that you're on, which we're not naming because we don't want to promote drugs because everyone is different and they need to talk to their doctors about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
It's registered on the HSE Drug Community Support Scheme. So a registered user, it would be in the drug payment scheme. So it's €80 a month. That's not means tested. That would be open to everyone.
I don't know about that now because mine doesn't fall under that. Like, I have to pay for mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. But I might go back now.
We will double check that just to make sure. But yeah. I thought we had checked that. But we'll come back to you.
Yeah.
On that for sure, because that'd be news be like, to you,
can
wouldn't
I have
it?
My money back, please.
Maybe it's been added in.
It might have just been added in. I haven't gotten I buy mine in bulk, so I haven't actually got mine since last year. So that could be a new revelation.
Because it's a daily thing.
Yeah.
And that is the danger here, isn't it? That the drugs might, some drugs are only available to those who can afford them.
That's always the worry, absolutely. Like, and we should be pushing for more fairer access to drugs that people need, especially something like this, without shame or stigma. It should be given to anyone who needs it.
Okay. You've been writing a column about various things. You're a writer, a very good writer as well as photographer.
Well,
and so
thank you very much.
And this is where this conversation came out of. But you're an adventurous kind of person, aren't you? And you like having sort of freedom in your life. But you do live differently to other people.
I do, yeah. And it is something I chat about, I guess, in the column. I guess that's why The Independent wanted me to talk in the column. I've never, you know, it's great. But I do like
different voices.
Different voices. And I do like to attack life differently. I'm very aware that life is very short. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And that it could be snatched away from you in an instant. So I take every opportunity when I can to travel and to enjoy myself and have the crack and live a very free life.
Is this because of an accident that you had?
I know.
What happened? You were near a bicycle?
I was on a bicycle. I was on an El Roher, and I was cycling up the Finglas Road, and the path is in a terrible condition. I hit a root of a tree and I went face first into a tree and knocked myself unconscious. Two lovely men pulled me out of the road, went up to the hospital, CTs, MRIs, all the works, and the doctor looked at me and looked at the scan and said, if you weren't wearing your bike helmet, you wouldn't be lying here now, you'd be lying in the morgue. And that to me was an awakening like no other. So when I recovered from that, I made a vow to really enjoy my life the way I want to live it. I took every bit of savings I had in my account and I went out and bought a camper van. And then I've just been enjoying my life. I've really been enjoying it.
And saying things like, which you don't often hear, you're looking forward to being middle-aged.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, people don't believe this, but I'm 39, but I had my 40th last year because I couldn't wait to have a massive 40th.
A lot of people spend their 39th year or, you know, being 39.
Yeah, I know.
Concerned about turning 40.
I'm going the other way. Yeah, no, I love it. I love being middle-aged. I love getting on with life. I love having the experience that I'm having.
And you've no interest in Botox or any of those?
Do you know, I think people should do exactly what they want to do. I have no interest in the hour-long Korean skincare routine that people put themselves through every night. You know, I'm not that person. I'm not that bothered. So just give me my life back and let me have the crack.
Another big decision that you've written about is the one to live child-free.
Oh, yeah.
Is this something you can talk about with other women without judgment?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a huge, huge community of women now who have made the same life choices that I have. And to stay child-free by choice is such an empowering thing. And it's something that we all need to talk about more often. So The Indo asked me to write about that last year. And I think as soon as I did it, my DMs on my Instagram were full of women who've read it and going, good on you. I made that choice. Sometimes, you know, it's brought up in family occasions where it's like, when are we going to get grandkids? What's going on? Or people are nervous talking to you around your choice because they feel like maybe it wasn't a choice and, you know, and they need to be sad for that and sad for you. Whereas mine, it was very much a defined choice. Myself and my partner were both like, we are not child friendly. We love them. They're great. You know, I've got god kids. They're brilliant. But for me, I'm really selfish and I love the life that I have.
And it's a kind of a final decision that you're very happy with.
Very, very, very content with. You know, I have big dreams to go retire in Paris with like about 10 dogs around me drinking wine outside a cafe at 11 a.m. and there's no children in that mix.
And himself, is he from Dingle or you met in Dingle?
Oh, we met in Dingle in the camper van. I know, yeah.
We got the van. Really paid off.
Oh yeah, the van. The van brought me him. That's why I'd love the van forever and ever.
There's lovely messages for you. What an articulate lady speaking so honestly about her weight affecting your health. Well done to you.
Oh, thanks.
I swear it's like Ruth is speaking my words, especially around the food noise. I've done all the diets, the points, the starving, the soups. It's a crap way to live. Thanks for highlighting this.
Great. That's the only reason I'm talking about this today, because I do find people are as desperate as I was and they're not aware of how accessible this is. Now, it's not easy. You might be nauseous, you might be everything else, but it is worth trying it if, like me, you've tried absolutely everything else.
Absolutely. We can enjoy your photographs because we're on the radio. People need to see what you've done. Ruthlessimagery.com.
Yes.
Ruthless Imagery.
And Ruthless Imagery on all platforms.
Ruth Medjber, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a million and good luck and be safe on the road.
Thank you so much.
Twenty years ago, folklorist Michael Fortune, who's been in with us before, but Michael and his wife Aileen Lambert, they went to Limerick City and they recorded a collection of stories from primary school children on both sides of the River Shannon, and it was called The Banshee Lives in the Handball Alley. It's a bit like Give Up Your Old Sins, I suppose, in a sort of a young rubber bandit style. And Michael's going to be returning to Limerick this weekend for an anniversary screening of the film, and he's hoping many of the original children will come along to that, and we might be talking to some of them a little bit later on. But first, Michael Fortune, welcome back to us. Tell us a little bit about how you and were you married? Aileen Lambert is your worthy missus in the world. How you went about collecting these stories? You went out to three schools in Limerick.
Yeah, we did. I'd been working in that area, kind of collecting them. Still am, but that particular one was a great starting point for both of us. You know, we went down. It was the arts officer at the time, Sheila Deegan. We asked us down to do something for the Cushla Poetry Festival, and the idea was to go in, Oliver, and to work with young lads and make little films. But sure, as soon as we went in, the young lads started telling us stories. And as soon as they opened their mouth and told us the stories, we said, "Jesus, we do very little here now, just press record and the lads and we'll be away with it."
Yeah.
And so they were lovely natural storytellers, real confident, lovely gorgeous accents, and so the stories then grew and grew over the weeks we recorded.
And the schools were St Mary's Boys National School, St Mary's Girls National School. I think they're now combined even since you were there in 2005, and it's in Munchen's Boys National School as well. The stories were all scary.
We were surprised to find, you know yourself when you talk about kind of folklore, banshee stories and fairy stories, you'll expect them really, a kind of a country pursuit, you know, that kind of way. The country wants to believe all that kind of stuff. But for these young lads, were good working class, inner city young lads, you know, yeah. They all had the stories passed down and safe from their mammies and daddies. Also as well, the transmission of stories, Oliver, was always brilliant, because I'd be up telling them, I'd be saying before we record, God, I heard a story at home in Wexford, we had this. And next week I go back and young lad would say, "My uncle told me this, sir." And I said, "What was it?" And then he'd tell me, I told you that last week. He said, "Oh no, you didn't, sir. That was my uncle told me that one." So, and it's just, that's the way stories get passed on. And then once we did a little screening in the school, sure, all the rest of them will pick up on it. And then the stories just grow and they grow their own legs.
It's lovely and innocent, even though it's only 20 years ago. And some, you think it's from many years ago. I wonder, has social media made them wise to microphones and being recorded, that they mightn't be as kind of given if you went to record to people now in 2025?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I we were always of the mind to make that camera disappear. So I started using the camera about 25 years ago. Now, the traditional folklorists and all them, all they'd be giving out to me, saying, "Oh, no one will talk in front of a camera." And I said, "Listen, if you can make that camera disappear, look someone in the eye and someone will talk to you." And they did. Now, the question which you raised, you'd wonder now, we're going back recording in the next couple of weeks, back in the same schools, in the same areas. Uh-huh. So it'll be interesting. Now, in me gut, I have a gut feeling that the stories are still there. I know that I trusted that they're still there. But I'd say maybe other parts of the country, they mightn't be there as much, you know, because people are getting their stories through phones, and they're quicker and they're faster. But the idea of definitely talking, and even the little ones talking, little lads talking. I always mention this. I remember one young lad told me a story about his uncle, and I was sitting down to edit it, and it was about 45 seconds long, and I met the mother maybe a couple of weeks later, and I asked her, I said, the young lad was telling me a story about the uncle. Oh, yeah. And she told me it in the lovely Limerick accent, and she paused and rose and fell in the exact same way as the young lad. So he'd literally heard that from her, like a piece of tune or a fiddle tune, and copied her word for word, and where the silences were like accents. You know better than that than anyone.
Passing on the oral history. Exactly. But the cadence, everything was the same in the same point of the story.
Yeah.
It meant there was a talent for storytelling in the family as well.
Absolutely. I think that's in us. It's in us still as a people. I think that there's something in the ground that's kind of just seeps up, I think.
There were great photographs of the screening you did when you did the film. Tell us where that took place.
I should have talked where I'm at, Oliver, I'll be honest with you. Myself an alien. And I suppose this was different. Like, I'm back here. I'm folklorist now, we've been introduced as, but my background is arts. And you'd have a couple of different slashes after your name, depending on what job, where you're working, right? Just the nature of your work. But I suppose that art sensibility was there. We always had the idea that we never owned the stories. The stories belonged to the people of Limerick. They belonged to the young lads. And I did not want to take them stories and put them on a library shelf for academics to ponder and question and pull apart. The stories were about getting back to the ground in Limerick. So we actually, one of the big stories was this story that the Banshee lived in the handball alley. And if you touch it, was a classic 1930s handball alley, I'd say it was, in the middle of a park by the Shannon. And all the young lads were told not to go there. So they said, if you touch the four corners and said Hail Mary backwards, she'll come after you, the Banshee will come after you. And they all had that story. And obviously the mammies and daddies invented it to keep them miles away from it. But we did
the scorch marks all around the handball alley. I mean, it was obviously a hangout place. That's why parents didn't want their kids hanging out there.
Absolutely.
The gangs of kids were just hanging around.
100%.
But that's where you do the screening.
We did a screen in it. As I said, people thought we were mad, but it was absolutely gorgeous. A cool March night. Got a marquee in, got rid of all the big bad lads.
So it was never a marquee.
There was never one since.
And screened it against the wall.
Screened it against the wall, and sure, the young lads all turned up, and buses turned up, and people from the other part of... See, the thing is, we didn't realise it as well, being from rural Wexford. Even different part, the other part of the city, sure, they were like a foreign land to them, you know. The boys in Ballinanty to come into St Mary's Park was a different space, you know.
That's but it
was
a lovely way to Mary's Park, is And is it still there?
God, no, that's a good question.
You'll find out, this weekend.
Yeah.
Where's the screening happening?
We're taking place. It's a great organisation, a woman called Monica Spencer, called the GAF. It's in Limerick City, and there's space is still available if you want to go to the screening. We would love to see all the participants there if we could.
You've really come up in the world.
Yeah.
into a proper place of screening. The cover of the DVD which you put out, and we sold quite a couple of hundred copies, I think, down in...
No, we gave them out.
Yeah,
we just gave them out. That was the thing with us, with the idea of ownership. We never, only in the last couple of years, I'm selling stuff. Someone said, you need to cop onto yourself and make a bit of a living for yourself by that.
But no, our arts project.
Exactly.
Give it away.
We had about 500 copies of the DVD, and that was before social media. And all the mammies and daddies and all got copies. And we reprinted it again, actually, because I'm looking at the DVD cover now. And there was a little boy in front of it called Stuart O'Connell. And we'd recorded September to March that 2004 and 5. And little lad died a couple of months afterwards. But he was on the cover.
Desperate.
It broke our hearts.
What happened to him?
As far as I know, the poor little creator got an asthma attack, as far as I know, but I stand corrected in that. But he was one of them children. He was just beaming. It was like a little star. And anytime we were in recording the schools, he was there and smiling. And his voice is still in the stories. So I suppose, compared to me, 20 years has passed. We have our own children now. These are all adults now. So there's a...
Well, there's an anniversary coming up for that family because it is 20 years ago.
Yeah. When we actually... You wouldn't believe it. When we actually just... Only about a week and a half ago, we decided we'd launched the project. We were going to do the screening. And someone contacted me and said, that was the little lad's birthday. That was his birthday and the day we launched it. So we couldn't believe it. But it's a lovely... Come here, it's a lovely... And I've been talking to his mammy over the years, back years ago and only recently. And we found loads of old photographs we took in the school and we gave them to her.
Wow.
So it'll be lovely. And even some of the people you have on here to talk. Sure, I was only editing up the videos yesterday of Tori, and I couldn't believe him. Just to see someone 20 years later, you know.
Yeah.
And look me in the eye as an adult.
Late 20s, early 30s now. Yeah. All these. We'll hear some of the stories of the kids. This is the scary toilet story. Isn't this? But it kind of speaks for itself.
Toilet, he went to sleep over, kept on going on. And the tap kept on going on after it. And my brother said, woke him up and said, your toilet won't stop flushing. And he said, no, we're getting the priest in to bless it tomorrow. And they phoned the plumber before they got the priest, and the plumber said, no, there's nothing wrong with the toilet. The priest came and blessed it. The toilet flushed again that night, and the devil came up and caught everyone in the family.
Did he just say, no, the accents can be hard to understand?
Yeah.
Did you have to draw them out, by the way? You weren't specifically asked them what's the story you've heard?
Yeah, and it was kind of loose enough now. We'd have a camera set up and you'd be just saying, you might hear the kind of classic ones or the banshee things, or good luck, bad luck. Like, there's loads of little things, like if you see one magpie, you know, everyone around the country would be spitting and blessing, or if they're walking down the street, this is the urban ones we didn't have. If you're walking down the street, two little lads holding their hands, you'd never split a pole because it'd break up your friendship. And one little one had
What did they do about the magpies in Limerick? Did they have a special way?
I think there was the waving at them, and sometimes it could have been spitting, you know, if you see.
Spitting
your hands, you clamp your hands, one. Yeah. The first magpies
stepping on crack. And the footpath as well was another one.
That was a lovely one. If you step on a crack, you break your mother's back, you know.
They all said that if you step on a crack, you break your mother's back, but no one believe it.
I don't believe it, because you can't just break your mother's back without her doing herself an injury.
Yeah, if you step on a crack, that's nothing. Who believe if you step on a crack, you break your mother's back? That's nonsense.
I stood on a crack once and my mother's back got injured over work.
I stepped on crack, my mother's back didn't break.
It's so deadpan and serious as well, isn't it? The title, the story from the title is The Banshee in the Handball Alley.
Yeah.
And there are two little girls talking about the banshee. We'll have a listen to them.
The banshee lives in the handball alley, and she has all grey hair, and she wears kind of black and grey kind of clothes.
It's like all a tour, a button, it's all tour.
And it's all rags. and she's grey hair and she's always brushing her hair, and if you ever see, if you ever hear her and don't look at her, just close the curtains or do go somewhere where you can't see her, because she'll throw the comb at you and she'll make you blind. Well, if you tip the four corners of the handball alley at night, at 12 o'clock at night, it can't be 1 minute past 12, it has to be bang on 12 o'clock. And if you tip the four corners of it, loads of bats will come flying out.
And that is the reason for the name, the Banshee and the Handball Alley. The Banshee Lives in the Handball Alley is the name of the DVD. The two little girls in that clip, Tori and Lisa, they're on the phone. Good morning to you girls.
Good morning. How are you?
How are you doing? I come to Tori first of all. Tori, what class were you in when the when Michael came to St Mary's and recorded those stories?
Fifth class.
Fifth class. And where in the world or what do you do in your life now?
I'm a primary school principal in County Clare.
In Shannon, to be specific?
Yes.
So you
yes,
never you never
in
left school?
Never left school. I finished in Mary Eye. I actually taught in St Mary's. I know Lisa's there now. Taught in St Mary's, was deputy in St Mary's, and wow. Then took principalship in Shannon. So was hard to leave, but yeah, when you look back at the video, it brings back even just listening to it, you can tell the people that are speaking, you know, you know they're your classmates, like, you know, it's
is that
lovely.
Right? You remember exactly. And yeah. Lisa, good morning to you.
Morning, Oliver, how are you?
Not so bad. You literally never left St Mary's.
Never left. It's lovely to be back. It is, yeah, it's nice to be back working in the school.
Sorry to take you out of class. But
no,
these are great memories.
It is, and it's like I have so many good memories growing up and going to St Mary's, so it's nice to be able to come back and be part of the memories in the kids' lives, and it's really nice, it is. And it's such a happy school to work in.
And Lisa, do you remember where you would have got the ghost stories, these kind of scary stories that you were telling Michael and Aileen back in the day?
I was trying to remember. I remember we used to go to Scouts. I think Tori was actually in Scouts with me.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to go camping on the weekends and we tell each other ghost stories, and I think a lot of them kind of came from that. And I remember my grandfather lived in the Castle Barracks. It was on the grounds of King John's Castle. There were 16 houses. Mm-hmm. They're actually knocked now. And when I was young, he was telling me loads of stories about when they were young growing up in the castle and the Banshee and the Handball Alley. And there was loads of stories. And from our classmates, I think it was a thing in school as well. We used to have little chats about it.
It's just an amazing story. Do you have kids yourself, Lisa, nowadays?
I have two little girls, yeah.
Do you think they know any of these stories around Limerick?
My eldest little girl is nearly 8, and I actually showed her the video. It was funny. She was watching it, but she didn't. She actually asked me who the Banshee was.
You were grateful for a
moment. She didn't know, yeah. Yeah.
Tori, over in Shannon, are you still seeing banshees and hearing about them?
No, definitely not. I don't know. I think it's, you know, because it's such a historic place, you know, it was a well-established, you know, housing estate. It was one of the first communities, I suppose, of Limerick City.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that, oh, what do you say, the old folklore, it stayed, it stuck. The same families lived there. They still live there. So
right.
The stories did get passed down. Like, I think in a lot of the places now, and particularly, I suppose, I've moved to West Clare, you know, there's been a lot of transients, a lot of move. Shannon has always had
right.
That transience that, you know, the stories unfortunately do get lost. But we are very lucky, I was saying to your colleague yesterday, that, like, it has been the same families in those parishes for many, many years. And it's lovely to see that the stories are still there for the families that live there. And as Michael was saying, like, he does believe the stories are still there when he goes back, and I would think the same, because it is the same families that are there.
He's going to find out. He's going to find out, I suppose. You kind of do expect the stories there, Michael, don't you, at least?
100% exactly agree with what Tori and Lisa just said. Yeah, absolutely. They're in the families and just passed down, and they'll never leave the people. And once you tell a child a story, that story will stay with them until the day they go.
Tori, the story of the is it the Green Lady? That's it's specific to Limerick, is it? Because it was on the bridge, or something to do with one
another? Yeah, well, I suppose that's the Bishop's Lady, but the Green Lady was, I suppose there is a green swamp on the riverbank that goes around St Mary's Park. It was definitely something we were told to keep us out of the water, because that's where we played. We cycled the bank, we walked the bank. Good. You know, we hung ropes off the trees, and that's where we played. It was definitely something that was made up to keep us out of the water, to keep us safe, but we truly believed that a green lady lived in the green swamp and that we could not go into the water.
They're very useful cautionary tales to keep you away from harm. And Lisa, maybe you can come in here with us. The kids gallivanted a little bit more in your day than they probably do now.
Yeah, I think now it's a little, like, it's a little bit more kind of, kids are kind of kept in more, and
yeah.
I suppose there's more kind of technology and things like that. But what I see in working in the school, kids do still go out around the area and play, and it's nice to see. You'll see kids cycling to school and they're cycling home, and when they're coming into school, they're chatting about their playing outside of school and stuff like that. So I think there is a little, they do still go out to play.
Okay, so you're giving us a bit of hope.
Yeah.
That the character and the culture remains alive. Thanks a million to you both. We'll let you back to class. That's Tori and Lisa in Shannon and in St Mary's as well, where the whole thing began. And Michael, the screening of The Banshee Lives in the Handball Alley is on the 22nd of March. That's on Saturday, isn't it? Saturday from 12 until half one in The Gaff on Lord Edward Street in Limerick City. No better place.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's still a few places left, so go to The Gaff and the Eventbrite and book your spot, and we'd love to see you there and participants there.
I hope you still find the yarns.
Ooh, they
thanks.
Will.
Michael Fortune, thanks so much. Now, welcome back. The WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32. Now, Adam Harris, founder and CEO of As I Am, which is the Irish autism charity, is this week's visiting critic. He's in studio. Welcome, Adam.
Good morning, Oliver.
Now, what discomfort zone did we send Adam to review for you? We sent him to experience sound bathing. Do we know how to describe this yet? I think it's a something like an immersive experience with tones, waves and resonances of sounds. We've been playing with all sorts of synonyms this morning.
Well, I have to be honest, when I was asked to do one by your team, I'd never heard of it before. So it was definitely a new experience, and definitely something that I think you need to describe and visualise, because it wasn't what I even visualised when I showed up yesterday. I think I imagined maybe sitting on the floor in a studio and maybe some chanting or some light background music.
Yeah.
But I went into the room and met a fantastic practitioner called Karen, who was running the session. It was a little bit like a therapy room. There was two seats, a coffee table, and then there was kind of a raised bed in the centre of the room. Right. And initially you had a conversation. She was really good. She kind of explained what to expect, what the session would involve. And then you're invited to lay on the bed,
yeah.
And they place a blanket over you. And then there was some background music playing, and that was turned off. And then, you know,
is it kind of yoga relaxing music?
Yeah, very kind of Eastern influence kind of music.
Oh,
and when I, you know, you're encouraged to close your eyes, and apparently a lot of people fall asleep or just relax. I knew, like, getting up on the gurney, that I'm not someone who can just think of nothing. So I knew
especially
that wasn't going to
be a gurney.
Exactly. That wasn't going to happen for me. So then what proceeds to happen is the practitioner continues to walk very, very slowly around the bed over the course of 1 hour.
Nice, yeah.
With a variety of different instruments. And it's strange because a lot of the time you're trying to keep your eyes closed, so you can't always see what they're holding. And I suppose it
is... Try to catch a sneaky look.
Yeah, you do. When you open your eyes, sometimes you see, gosh, that person has a big hammer in the air. I think I'll close my eyes. This is a bit scary. And, you know, they're ringing different kind of chimes and bells, but really kind of had nearly like a cymbal you'd see off a drum, and they were hitting it with a hammer.
Oh, my gosh.
But slowly moving it across your body, up your body, and around your head. Certainly for the first 20, 30 minutes, those noises at times were, they were nearly like a funny frequency on a radio. Or that sensation whereby, you know, when you're on a flight and your ears pop, and it's like the sound is skewed some way. So as a sound sensitive person, I mean, I wasn't loving that bit. But there was elements of it that were really nice. One of the more unusual things was about, I'd say, 3/4 of the way through the session, a large bowl, a really heavy bowl, nearly shaped like an urn or something, a pestle and mortar, is placed kind of on the small of your chest. And they begin to essentially rub the kind of trumpet thing around it. And it feels like the sound is in your body. So it's a really...
The vibrations go through
deep
you.
Deep pressure kind of thing. And
that's
an
interesting experience.
That was really nice. And I suppose I wasn't able to sit still, so I found myself tossing and turning.
There's no way you were going to fall asleep.
No, I spotted a clock towards the end of the session. I was glad I didn't see that at the start, because one of the things that really stayed with me was you've no idea how long an hour is doing nothing. Like, I'm someone who's constantly scrolling on my phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really strange to just do nothing, think of nothing, and have this experience for an hour. So they finished up with some light chimes then, and had a nice chat with Karen after, and she was explaining that, you know, often people say they have experiences, so maybe they go back to happy memories and so on. I just said, you know, I found it really kind of an interesting experience. It was, again, kind of interesting to try and think of nothing and fail for an hour.
Couldn't switch off.
No, but when
Was it the clock? Did the clock suddenly go, oh, I've got this appointment, I must...
No, I think it's really hard to think of nothing, isn't it? Like, going to sleep at night, I'd always have something like on in the background, like a podcast that you can kind of zone into. But I suppose it was that sense of nothing to concentrate on, in a sense, except these noises, some of which were quite overpowering and some of which were relaxing. But you're still very kind of conscious the whole time, I found. But then when I went up Nassau Street afterwards, I did feel completely dazed. So it does have some sort of an impact. And I did sleep particularly well last night.
Interesting.
Don't know, was that a hard day's work or the experience? But I think we'll give it to Karen that it was something in it.
So because you did this on a working day, you just had come from work?
Dressed in my work clothes. So I didn't exactly look like I was going to enter a new dimension or something. But
I wouldn't say many suited people go for a sound bath.
No, I wouldn't think so. And I think you can do a sound bath in a class. So I don't know how it would be structured in that sense. Intense because it was one to one, I suppose.
Yeah, that would be, you'd be hearing all the other sound. That might be a little bit too much. When we contacted you and said, look, this is a slot where you get out of your comfort zone, I think we initially suggested the two things you said, sport and music.
Yes.
That you're not terribly interested in.
Exactly. I think, you know, outside of the work that I do, we often joke that, you know, anything that happened in the last 200 years, I'm not much used to, because I love history and things like that. I was funny, you know, I think we talked about maybe me doing a GA training session or
that
a yoga class.
So idea. That was,
I tried to pick the activity that preserved my dignity the most.
So it was more in the music end of things. And it did sound like it was going to be a difficult one, didn't it? Sound bathing, because...
Yeah, I definitely. And I think I went into it not knowing kind of what to expect at all. But certainly as the session went on, there was elements of it that would definitely be uncomfortable for someone who's sensory sensitive.
Yeah.
And then there was elements that were really interesting. So it's off the bucket list, but it was worth doing, I think.
Would you do it again?
I don't know. Again, if I take something from it, I think it is interesting to just try and have some disconnect time. I don't think you can disconnect from everything, from just kind of sitting, scrolling on your phone. That's a really alien experience. So I thought that was my main takeaway from yesterday.
I like to think if it depends on what you're scrolling on your phone.
Well, that's true.
So you've got, oh, no, this is highbrow content.
I think blue it's usually not.
Someone said sound baths are fantastic. It's the most wonderful way to finish the week and start the weekend. That's from Breed. I mean, that's kind of the experience you had from, you slept well.
I think it was really positive. And again, I would just praise if people were interested in experiencing it, the Dublin Wellbeing Centre, they were really good. And, you know, I don't know if they knew I was an autistic person or not, but even they were very kind in terms of explaining what the session was going to involve, talking through the different tools, you know, letting me know if anything's uncomfortable. So, you know, I think if someone wants to dip their toe in the water, definitely that's a place
very
to try.
Good. And you, if you're having a sensory experience like that, you would need to know in advance particularly what's happening.
I think we would often encourage, I think certainly for our community, as much predictability as possible is really important.
So, in everything,
you know, from seeing the environment to knowing what the sensory surroundings are going to be like.
There's going to be a vibrating bowl on the chest.
Exactly, that's always useful.
That's for everybody to know, but particularly for the community. How are you with comfort zones? What are you most comfortable doing then? Is it literally sitting down, reading? Is that what you do for your downtime?
Yeah, so like there's probably a few things I like to do when I'm off. Reading is probably one of my favourite things. I enjoy walking and listening to podcasts. A couple of summers ago, I went through a really intense period where I walked home every night from Blackrock to the city centre. Didn't get to do that last summer, but really enjoyed.
Every day?
Yeah, really enjoyed that kind of movement and just kind of.
How long does that take?
It used to take me about an hour and a half. About an hour and a half, yeah.
That must have been brilliant for fitness.
It was really good. So probably should get back at that at some stage. And then the other thing was I love making Lego. I have a few really nice pieces at home, like a Lego typewriter and the Taj Mahal. And I'm working on Notre Dame at the minute. So that's a little thing I like to.
I looked up in the Notre Dame one. It's 4,000 pieces. Is that the one you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to stand on it.
They come with the big Bible-sized books of instructions.
Huge and loads of bags. And exactly.
When did you get that?
I got it for Christmas. So we're making slow progress. You know, it took 1,000 years to build. So I think we'll hopefully we'll get the Lego set made a bit quicker than that.
As long as it doesn't get burned down.
Exactly.
Halfway through. So that, because you don't have a lot of free time, because As I Am keeps you very busy.
As I Am is really intense. So I've been leading As I Am for the last 11 years now, and we're Ireland's autism charity. And I suppose we provide supports both directly to autistic people, but also place a huge emphasis on trying to make society more accessible. I suppose we've become more aware of autism than ever before, but that doesn't mean we really understand or accept it. So while autism in a nutshell might be a hard thing for listeners to get their head around, in As I Am, what we try and explain really simply is that doesn't everyone in society deserve the same chance? Mm. And autistic people at present don't receive that, whether it's access to school, access to services, but making friends, you know, participating in community activities. We face barriers, others don't. And in As I Am, we're trying to make those barriers visible and knock them down.
I mean, we've had this conversation only recently. Rady Pete and Dan Lambert were talking about the access for kids early on, and they mentioned As I Am and the support they got. In terms of your working week then, what do you do from day to day? Are you around the country, or do you base yourself in an office? Or?
So we're based in Blackrock in County Dublin, but one of the things we're really excited about at the moment is we're opening a new model of support called a one-stop shop, which are going to be regional hubs to support the community. So we're about to open one in Dublin and one in Galway and have ambitions to spread those. But I suppose my week, what really is interesting about it is obviously being autistic is a whole of life experience, and there's no aspect of society we don't need to make more accessible. So I could be in a school in the morning, I could be in a workplace in the afternoon, and in the evening I could be with a community group, or, you know, visiting somewhere really unusual like a public service or the Garda College. So our aim is to really try and mainstream that understanding. So it means that me and my team would travel a huge amount, and, you know, no 2 days look the same, which is part of what makes the job interesting, because certainly, perhaps somewhat ironically, it definitely pushes you outside of your comfort zone all of the time.
Right.
But it also lets you kind of, I suppose, see parts of society that you may never see, and try and, I suppose, move the conversation of autism beyond just that concept of services towards that idea of citizens living in the community.
So you're working very hard.
Yeah, it's really busy. We're going through a major expansion as we kind of go into our second decade of activity, and it's a particularly busy time of the year. It's World Autism Month, so I suppose this is our opportunity to connect with communities across Ireland and build that understanding. I suppose sometimes we've put such an emphasis in society on just access, because autistic people have to fight so hard for that. Mm. But what we don't maybe think about is we haven't actually changed how things work to make them accessible. So even if we look at our education system, whereby, yes, there's a fight to secure a school place, but then there's still no mandatory training in autism for teachers.
Right.
So that outreach piece is really, really important, and it you know, challenges us every day.
When you're travelling around, obviously that's another sensory experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Do autistic people drive? Are they okay with that sort of experience?
So I don't drive.
You don't drive.
Have lots of people do. So no two autistic people are the same, but I would kind of not be the most coordinated person in the world, not the most consistent concentration. So it's probably good for everybody that I use public transport. But I suppose from my perspective, one of the things that is interesting for me in terms of public understanding of autism is the whole area of stimming. So I would walk a lot, you know, from one meeting to another, in and around Dublin and so on. And one of the ways that I stay regulated is by stimming. So,
and explain stimming to people.
Yeah, so stimming is any repetitive action that an autistic person does in order to stay regulated. So while people are listening to this interview, perhaps they're fidgeting in one way or another. That's and right. We all do that. And perhaps stimming is sometimes a more obvious and more important form of fidgeting. So it's just like the fan in the computer. It's what keeps the system regulated. So, you know, when I've been sitting for too long, when I'm excited, when I'm worried, when I'm deep in my own thoughts, I'll begin to stim. And if I'm sitting in a chair, that will look like me beginning to bounce in the chair.
Oh, right.
If I'm walking, which is the more common one, you will see me run quite erratically up the street on my tiptoes. I've no decision as to when I want to do that. So I
is
can't
it? Okay.
Say
it just happens.
Now is the time. It just happens. But I feel a huge release of energy. It's a really positive experience, and it helps me kind of calm down and reconnect. The challenge is when you're a younger child, perhaps people don't pay too much heed, or at least you'd hope not. When you're a 30-year-old man, people stare all the time.
That's right.
People comment, people take pictures. And for me, that's useful for my work, because it shows the journey we still need to travel in terms of public attitudes.
Does that still happen to you?
Oh, yeah. On a weekly basis, you would see people take pictures, mimic, comment. Doesn't bother me, but it would be
mimic.
Enough to make, oh yeah, very much so, on the street, you'd see, you know,
random people on the street.
Oh yeah, and pointing out and so on. And that's enough to make autistic people feel unsafe. It's obviously very humiliating. It's something that autistic people need to be able to do in order to feel safe within our society. And yet the reality is many people don't, you know. We poll public attitudes to autism every year, and what we see is that gap between what people want to do and think they know and how they apply that to day-to-day situations. And, you know, in our last Same Chance report, which is kind of our state of the community report, 40% of autistic people said they didn't feel safe when out and about in their community. So there's still a huge amount of work to be done to break down those barriers so people can. And I think it's particularly important as we see more and more autistic people aging out of our school system. 1 in 20 children in school now have an autism diagnosis. And I think it's really important that people can feel that, you know, they can be out and about in their own community.
What do you, how do you cope with that when someone starts mimicking or doing something like that randomly in public?
I mean, I don't think it's a pleasant experience, but for me, it's something that I'm very used to. And I try and take a positive from it, which is I try and say, well, that actually shows us the work that we still need to do. It's real time market research is how I try and approach it. But it obviously is an unpleasant experience. And for some autistic people, it can be enough to make people feel really unsafe. You know, it starts in school and it works the way up. And that's kind of what the name of our charity is about, because, you know, the reality is autism is an invisible difference. In our communities across the country, there are people who don't have a diagnosis and there are people who, you know, don't want to share their experiences. The only way we can build a society that's inclusive is that when we see people, you know, interacting with their world differently, that we accept people as they are. And that's the really important message going into this World Autism Month.
What should people do? What's the polite thing to do if someone is stimming in front of them and they don't know them, or they don't know even that they're autistic?
It's simply a case of respecting a person's space out in public. You know, the reality is sometimes when people see it, they may feel uncomfortable, they may think it looks funny, they may stare. But the important thing to do is simply to ignore it. You know, if you think the person is in distress and they're with somebody, you can double check if the person needs any support. But generally speaking, it's about just respecting the person and leaving the person alone.
Okay, that's what you do. Well, fair play to you. You've a bulletproof mind anyways, don't you, that you can find the positive out of that. Other positive things happening in your life. You got engaged last year or the year before. Congratulations.
Yeah, so wedding coming up on the 2nd of August in Foden.
Very soon.
Very soon. So lots of organising going on at the moment. Lots of to do this.
Himself is Daniel.
Daniel, absolutely.
And what's Daniel doing in his life?
Daniel is an English and history teacher.
I can see the attraction already.
Exactly. And he's an unusual person in that he is from Dublin but studied in Cork and has a love for Cork. So we met down there, and as a result, we are going to get married there. So it's a special
really?
Place for us.
Really? Oh, like Cork has become this, this
exactly.
place. And you went to UCC. Is that where you met?
No, I actually was working down in Cork. Daniel went to UCC. He did his studies there. I went to university after school, but found that transition quite overwhelming, and it was around the time I was setting up As I Am. So I decided to kind of take a step back, take a year out, and then I haven't managed to quite get back to the studies yet, because As I Am has just kind of become all encompassing.
And who's the organiser? I mean, you're highly organised individuals, I presume. Has it fallen to you?
It depends who you're interviewing, but I would say it's definitely me. I have that advantage this morning.
You have the one-sided version. Has everything done? Invites, guests?
Yeah, we have that out, and all the major things are booked. So it's just
one of the hardest things
logistics,
to do.
Exactly. Yeah. We had a good run in. I think we got engaged in 2023, so we had our time to get things.
That's the average about it. But you're a young man, actually, quite young for marriage, even. I think same-sex couples tend to be older.
Sure.
The average age is about 40 now.
Yeah, that's right. And though it seems the right time, because we met, I think, back when I was 22. So we're going together near the better part of a decade. So it's exciting.
You're about 30 now, are you?
Yeah, I turned 30 just a couple of months ago. So I was saying to your researcher, you know, I'm starting to have those confronting moments. I had to get glasses for the first time the other week, and I found a few grey hairs in the mirror.
30.
Yeah.
The grey hairs are definitely from all the work you're doing.
I don't know.
And will you have music at the wedding? Will there be?
Yeah, indeed. We're having a string quartet for the ceremony. We both love Lord of the Rings. So we're having some of those and some traditional Irish songs as well. And then we have the kind of typical wedding band booked for the evening. So,
And will there be sensory? Because I presume you have autistic friends, obviously,
absolutely.
As well. And
yes, so we'll be making accommodations. So we'll have a quiet space that people can go to. We'll issue a visual guide before the day. And they're the sort of changes. You know, the funny thing about this is when we talk about the accommodations that are so essential for autistic people, you know, they're actually good for everybody. They don't harm anybody. And we actually poll public attitude. Who doesn't prefer clear communication? Who doesn't prefer a supportive sensory environment? Who doesn't prefer to know what to expect? And who doesn't prefer a non-judgmental community? So being autism friendly can work for everybody.
Because you're a Gen Z couple getting married, does that mean you met online or did you meet in person because you were down in Cork?
Yeah, we met in person at an event in Cork. Old-fashioned, exactly.
Finally, somebody. Yes. Okay, good. And you just cracked along and that's it now.
That's it. The rest is history, as they say.
I have to ask you about Rosie O'Donnell.
I know. It's an incredible situation. It wasn't on my bingo card at all. I was sitting at home about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it was one Friday night, I think, and I got a text from a contact in the Ireland Funds who do great work, you know, in Irish America, yes, and so on, and support As I Am. And they said, Rosie O'Donnell's been in touch with us. She's looking to have a conversation. She's in Ireland. Would you be prepared to meet her? So I said, of course. So we had a meeting, and, you know.
So she came looking for you, even though the entire world's media were searching. Where the heck has Rosie O'Donnell gone? We know she'd moved to Ireland because she announced it online. So she came and found you.
And I think it just shows the strength of the autism community. You know, that you're part of this community of people where you can seek each other out. And, so, you know, wherever you go in the world, there's so many barriers for autistic people. And, you know, it's important that our community comes together and shows how to navigate them. So, you know, in terms of As I Am, we run support programs that we hope Rosie and her daughter will be able to benefit from. Yes. And also, we're obviously working to make society more inclusive. So I think Rosie has been very involved in philanthropy. She wants to make a big impact in autism. So she said, I'm going to be in Ireland for a period of time, and I want to support the work of
Alzheimer's. She's here with her child and their support dog.
That's right, and they're going to be with us on the 5th.
Where did you meet?
So we met at Hope, and we had some lunch, and she's visited the office since, and we're gearing up for World Autism Month, and the first thing Rosie said to us is, how can I support you? So on the 5th of April we're having our Same Chance Walk. It's an opportunity to come out and show your support for the autism community, but also raise much needed funds for As I Am supports right across the country. So Rosie will be with me in Malahide Castle on the 5th of April. You can also go to Lockheed Forest Park in Roscommon, or you can join a walk locally, and all the information's on asiam.ie.
Your best friends now, Rosie O'Donnell.
It seems to be the case, yeah. And she's an absolutely lovely woman, and it's her birthday today. So I might say a big happy birthday to Rosie O'Donnell.
Happy birthday to Rosie O'Donnell. Yeah. She's going to be on the Late Late Show
absolutely
tonight,
talking about As I Am and how people can support our work.
That's brilliant. Camille, how's she getting on in Ireland? I presume you talked about that.
I think she's really excited to be here. I don't think, you know, she feels very much at home here. She's from an Irish American family. Mm-hmm. She's been really, I suppose, moved by everyone she's met just in the community, in the shops, you know, through her child. You know, has just been really amazed by how kind everybody is. You know, she feels it's a very different atmosphere here right now than there is in the United States. And I suppose, you know, when you look at some of the things that are happening in the US at the moment, you know, there's been an executive order signed to reduce the prevalence of autism. There's a huge amount of misinformation. So I'm not surprised.
I missed that executive order.
Yes, well, there's so many, it's hard to keep up. Yeah,
that's going on there. And is she funny in person?
She is really, really funny, but also really kind of thoughtful as well. You know, I always think it's an amazing measure of a comedian like yourself, when you can have a serious conversation and a very funny conversation. Yeah, and yeah, she definitely has that skill.
It's great that she's here, but it's gas that you're hanging out together having lunch.
Definitely worth tuning in tonight.
For sure. And I don't know if you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Didn't know about the show, but I was told about it since I've met Rosie. She
plays a heightened version of herself.
Yes.
It's kind of fascinating.
And it's kind of improv, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she has a kind of a intellectual fury about her.
Yeah,
think,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but we'll find out more about her in the late. Well, tell us what's happening. The World Autism Month, is that next month, is it?
So World Autism Month kicks off on the 1st of April.
Okay.
The 2nd of April is International Recognised Day, World Autism Day. And as I said, it's our chance to build on awareness towards understanding and acceptance. We have thousands of people now accessing our support services. 11,000 people have accessed the As I Am Autism Information Line since 2021. We've thousands of families accessing our free supports through the Child and Family Support Programme and the Adult Support Programme. But every place that we have, we could fill 10 times over. So we really need to raise funds in April and raise understanding. And one way you can do that is by going to a Same Chance Walk in your community, supported by PTSB.
With yourself and Rosie O'Donnell leading it off.
Absolutely. And Eric Roberts as well. Yeah.
And Eric Roberts.
Yes.
There are lots of messages coming in for you, Adam. As a third level lecturer who works with autistic students, I'd like to commend Adam on his excellent advocacy for people with autism, Paul O'Brien in MIC in Limerick. This other one says, thanks to As I Am, we got a travel ID for our son, which has made travelling much easier. It's recognised in a number of countries. They also provide autism stickers for cars for parking. One of the retail parks in Limerick has a specific parking. We'd love to see it elsewhere. That's from David in Galway. That's kind of just letting people know.
Yeah, our Autism ID card program is really popular. It's just, I suppose, a subtle way to self-advocate. We're issuing hundreds of those cards every month now. And it's just a tool where people can discreetly ask for a little bit more support, whether it's here in Ireland or whether it's when they're travelling internationally and may require proof of disability.
I've never heard of stimming, says this person, but now I know and I understand when someone does it, what is happening. This needs to be discussed more to give people more understanding. Well done, says Ciara Burke from Dooleek. So she'll pass on the message.
Yes, spread the word.
Who is Rosie O'Donnell and what does Trump have to do with her? Someone who's obviously arrived, welcome back from your coma.
That's a podcast.
Which would be going on since they have beef going back to 2006, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you talk about Trump, by the way, with Rosie O'Donnell?
Yeah, and I think, you know, she very much wants to focus on the positives and looking ahead. I think it's, you know, she's here for a reason because I think she wants to leave that behind, but I think is just really horrified by what's going on. And, you know, I think there's a real worry about the misinformation that's going to be spread about autism through this administration, and
yes,
that's going to affect all of us.
Yes, and it's connected to false information about vaccines as well.
Exactly.
Bizarrely.
And I suppose this idea that being autistic is the problem as opposed to living in a society that doesn't support you being the problem.
Going back to the sound baths, Adam, went for three group meetings of sound baths. One of them was amazing. Sent shivers down my spine. Brilliant. I mean, yes. If shivers down your spine is your thing. I hope you didn't physically get shivers down your spine.
It's in good working
but
order.
Thanks a million for being such a good sport.
Thank you so
and,
much.
And for, like, Rosie O'Donnell is in good company that she's meeting people like you representing the country. So how are your parents, by the way? Are they coping with having two famous sons?
Oh, they're very supportive. And we have a sister, Gemma, as well, who keeps us all on the straight and narrow.
She's probably the cleverest of all because she keeps out of the limelight.
The matriarch of the siblings, and certainly as well, if anyone is listening this morning and they are members of the autism community, they haven't heard of As I Am before, you can contact us Monday to Thursday on our support line, which is 0818 234 234, or support@asiam.ie, or at any stage you can get in touch on asiam.ie.
As I'm watching it there, I'm thinking, this guy's going into sales. You've done, like, I know that charity is your passion and your career at the moment, but you're only 30 years of age. We don't know what you're going to do in your career.
Yeah, I suppose we're really proud of what we've achieved over the last decade, but I think the mountain in front of us is just so large when you consider the autism self-advocacy movement is in its infancy when you look at other forms of kind of equality movement. So we've a long journey ahead of us. We're seeing progress, but we just need to do it so much faster, and I'm going to keep focused on that for as long as I can.
You're 5 years under the threshold for a run at the Oros. But, you know, if it's a one-term president.
That's very nice. But I think there'll be plenty of people signing up for that come November. So we'll see what happens.
Not ruling himself out for the next one. Listen, as Adam Harris and As I Am, which is well promoted now at this stage, I barely need to see, but asiam.ie, we can register for your own walk or join the one in Malahide Castle or Lochee in beautiful Roscommon, lovely part of the country as well. Thanks a million and have a lovely weekend.
Thank you so much.
And good luck in August to yourself and Daniel.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations. There you go. Some great chats from the past week. It is the end of the podcast. As you know it, if you've interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an email anytime at all. Oliver at RTE.ie. Happy weekend to you all. Agus slán.